And hello, welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats, or perhaps the other tagline is films from the VHS era, though this film that we're doing is not on VHS. Our film for this episode is Clash of the Titans from 1981, and we have it on Laserdisc.
We do.
So not VHS, but Laserdisc, but 81, VHS era. It would have been on VHS. Getting it, I think, from the Squirrel Hill Exchange for $5 in the last 2 years, because I didn't get a Laserdisc player until my birthday last year, wasn't it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So it's only, so we've only had it in our possession for a little more than a year, because, of course, you turn 42, you buy a Laserdisc player. That's just how getting older works, I think.
It wasn't the red convertible. You went for the Laserdisc.
I went for the Laserdisc. I got the CED on my 40th birthday. And Betamax was this summer, so. Which that machine still needs, I think, a little bit of lube, a little bit of cleaning before we can start.
Actually, yeah, this one was supposed to be a Betamax review, but the Betamax player needs a little finessing.
Little tender love and care, since it might not have been plugged into an electrical outlet since about 1984. Until I got it earlier this summer, and it just doesn't know what to do with all of that electricity and demands on its functionality. So
with that, anyway. Our runner-up was Clash of the Titans, the 1981 film, which was the final film for Ray Harryhausen, who is famous for his claymation. My favorite one was the seventh voyage of Sinbad was one of my favorite ones that he did. But you know, any films in like the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s where you saw claymation, it was usually him who did it.
Yes.
And boy, is this film filled with claymation.
Yes. I guess another way we could think of this is, you know, speaking of claymation, perhaps we're also doing this in honor, sort of, or coincidence of the Seattle NHL expansion team choosing the name The Kraken
this week. True.
And there is a Kraken, because Clash of the Titans is also... Oh, Joseph Campbell, what did you do to movies in the post-Star Wars world? Just this, you know, playful mishmash, like Nordic and Greek mythology. It's all old. It's old people and their stories, you know, ancient, you know, it's all the same. Same culture, same everything. Just throw it together. Put a Kraken in there. Got yourself Medusa. You got Zeus. You got some gods. It's all good.
Reverse Styx.
Hero's journey, right?
Yeah. Well, so that's a good place to start, because it is a little bit of a mishmash. Not as bad as Percy Jackson, which, if you're of a certain age, you associate Perseus with Percy Jackson. Which Percy Jackson makes Perseus the son of Poseidon and gives him the powers of Poseidon, where Perseus is actually the son of Zeus. But the Kraken is definitely Norse mythology. It is not Greek mythology.
And also kind of looks like Godzilla.
It does, where a Kraken is typically a giant squid or octopus, is usually how a Kraken is.
Or a Godzilla-y thing with a tail.
Yeah. So this one is a Godzilla-y thing with a tail.
But
multiple arms.
Yes.
So, I mean, it is its own distinct thing. It does have...
Yes.
It's actually like a combination of like the creature from the Black Lagoon and Godzilla.
Yeah, that's a fair representation.
It's like if they had a baby together.
The Kraken of this film.
That's what it would look like if they had a child together.
Which, the fact that we're talking about the Kraken and that we're already in this hole, maybe I think we need to get down to the real thing about this film. Is there a lot of there in this film?
I
watched two films since...
And this is we had the least conversation about
this
Clash
film,
of the Titans.
Yes.
So, you know, we had the conversation of the hero's journey and of the epic poem. and how, like, with an epic poem, you don't get a lot into, like, the inner workings of a character. So for this particular film, for me, Perseus is just a very flat character.
Yes.
He's very static. He doesn't grow or develop or change over time. There isn't even, like, an opportunity for him to, like, figure out his powers. And so, spoiler alert, though he is the son of Zeus, he literally has no powers. Like,
he's got some magic stuff.
He has magic
stuff. But he's not magic.
He's not magic. And he's played by Harry Hamlin, who... Harry Hamlin, you know... did a great job of being attractive in this movie. I think you said he did the he would have been great in Zoolander.
He's got a nice blue steel.
He has a blue steel look
that chews up a lot of the scenery in this film. But in some ways, you know, though this film deviates from source material, maybe it actually re-inherits a problem with the source material, having taught, you know, ancient Greek literature and having taught especially the Odyssey.
Yeah.
One of the things, you know, you have to make a point of when you're teaching that in a collegiate setting, right, is this belief of the rich inner self and inner journey of people, really not... They're in ancient literature. There's no soliloquies. In the Odyssey. There's no point Odysseus goes off and says, this is what I'm thinking right now, or, you know, whatever. Which you get in Shakespeare, which you get in sort of Renaissance and post-Enlightenment culture, and certainly the novel and the way the novel makes us think about what makes a story.
Yeah.
In this case, yeah, Clash of the Titans keeps that... lack of inner conflict or the rich inner world of the individual kind of not there. It's just Perseus has got to go do some things.
Yeah.
And he does some things. That character, change, grow, have inner conflict, have inner doubt, have inner, you know, this way that as a true protagonist, you know, you have to make a choice of between maybe... I've heard protagonists describe in a fiction writing workshop as, you know, that's the character that has to question their values.
Right.
And question their claim to knowledge. Doesn't happen in this film.
Does not at all. Not at all. He is, as I mentioned, a very flat character. And actually even, like, reaction-wise, you know, like, for example...
He's got blue steel.
For example, like, you wake up and there's giant scorpions kind of trying to kill you. You think you would have some sort of reaction. He actually even doesn't really react to situations either. He's just, like, a very stoic character.
Very stoic, and you wonder, like, yeah, there's a lot of blue screen, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of sort of reacting to things that aren't there, or...
That's true. But I think
however that worked.
The funny part for me is, like, they have actually a pretty stellar cast, right?
Burgess Meredith,
Ursula Andress, Maggie Smith, and then of course Laurence Olivier in this film. They got Laurence Olivier
as Zeus. Which is the other weird thing, and you notice this within the first 10 minutes of the film. Everybody has their own accent. And yes, it's ancient Greece, but all of the really smart, noble people are British. It's that way that the British accent is just like, it's like English plus, you know, it's just like a little bit better English. They use that, yeah, so Sir Laurence Olivier is Zeus in this.
Fortunately, it was not his last film. So that would have been, you know, horrible to have your career end on this particular film, because there is an actor that I love whose last film was Xanadu. So at least Laurence Olivier did not end on Clash of the Titans.
No, he did a Lifetime movie after.
Oh,
that.
Did he? Okay.
Gene Kelly did a Lifetime movie about 5 years later, but
it's so funny because I feel like it was almost like. So the director and film writer actually didn't do really anything huge. So this is Clash of the Titans is for the most part their best known mass work. So they're both more famous in Britain, and Maggie Smith was married to the screenwriter. So I think that kind of explains why she was in this particular film, but it feels like they almost were like, you know, they, I think they wanted this epic feel to it, and it's like, mm-hmm. let's get Laurence of Olivia, you know, or, and it's just insane that they got him and some of these other actors to be in this particular film. The most interesting, actually, part for me is that Ursula Andress and Harry Hamlin started an affair and had a child together. So that's actually, for me, the most interesting thing that came out of this movie.
That there was a Gen Xer made.
That was a Gen Xer made in this film.
Oh, actually, technically millennial. It was 1981.
Oh, that's true. So with this, but for this particular film, you know, it is based on the mythology of Perseus, and it does follow some of the things of Perseus. I mean, he does defeat Medusa, he does save Andromeda, you know, Cassiopeia is Andromeda's mom, he does eat meat the witches. So they do include some of the things. But, you know, they do deviate, like, actually Pegasus is born of Medusa. So there's a couple, there's some things that they switch around with it. And again, the Kraken is a Norse mythology thing. And then actually, technically, Medusa and the Kraken are not Titans. Hence the title of Clash of the Titans. The Titans were the original old gods that predated the Olympian gods. And so Medusa and... there is sea creatures came from the Titans. They are children of the Titans, just like Zeus is a child of the Titans. But they're technically not Titans. So even the title is not correct.
It's busted, yeah.
And actually, I think actually that's a big thing to talk about is there really isn't a Clash of the Titans, to be honest with you. There's no big epic battle between Medusa and the Kraken, who are billed as the Titans, but there is no big... battle between the two of them.
Yeah, no.
She's just a means to an end for Perseus.
Yes.
But I think in the sense of this, it is, there is some things that are definitely true. For me, especially the cattiness of the gods. I actually, that's the one part I do find amusing, is I think they do get that correct. So yes. if you have read any Greek mythology, you know that the gods are temperamental and can be bitches and do things on the whim. So that is definitely a part of this particular film, especially Maggie Smith, who is playing, actually I forgot this goddess, because you always think about Poseidon. Poseidon, actually, his only role in this film is to release the Kraken and to look concerned, like, have this look of wonder as he releases the Kraken. But she is Thetis, which is the goddess of the sea. It's the female counterpart to Poseidon. She's the one who really moves the action, because her son, Calibos, you have to say it in a certain way, Calibos. Calibos is cursed by Zeus, which sends her in a tizzy, which moves the events forward with Perseus.
Yeah, and Poseidon doesn't really do a whole lot. I mean, he kind of, like, has this shot that keeps happening where he, like, sort of, like, swims up in front of the camera and his mouth is open, like, and that's it.
That's it. That's...
which you could have got Stallone for that, probably. He was a hot property then, but I guess in 81, coming off Rocky.
But Poseidon... who is actually one of my favorite gods. And Hades, there's no Hades. I mean,
there's no Hades,
how do you leave out Hades? You know, that he doesn't even show up at all. But though you have, you know, Athena represented, you actually have, you know, Ursula Andress playing Aphrodite, their roles are actually really, really limited. It's just a couple.
There's a lot of really limited roles in this film. I think that's one of the things for me, and it's like, it's almost for me, you know, we watched this on Friday, and we're recording this Saturday, and more than 24 hours later, for me, it's like, I really struggle to think about what to say about this film, because there's a lot of really limited roles.
Yeah.
There's a lot of flat characters.
Yeah.
And so, and it's not necessarily, though, you talked about, like, the famous effects claymation person. The effects don't look great.
Mm-mm.
If anything, I mean, there's a cute owl. There's a cute owl. That's Bobo. Bobo, the metallic golden owl. That's really R2-D2. That sounds like R2-D2. That,
yeah.
I mean, for me, it's like this film, part of it is, and you know that George Lucas consulted with Joseph Campbell or also other students of Jung in writing this sort of archetypal film. Yeah, I wonder, does this film get made only because it comes in the giant bow wave that Star Wars made, and it's like, well, how do we do epic hero journey?
Yeah.
But
sword,
you know,
and sorcery.
Sorcery, yeah. How do we do it? Well, we put in ancient Greece. How do we get the, like, fun beepy robot in there? You know, like, they had to figure out how to get the fun beepy robot in ancient Greece. And, yeah, Bobo, Bobo steals the show. Bobo is the star of the film, is the most compelling character, is the character that's often in the most peril that I cared the most about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it was kind of cute, you know, like, Harry Hamlin, whatever. I mean, you know, he's going to probably beat the Kraken, but...
Well, actually, the first time I saw this movie was at a drive-in theater, and it was double feature of Star Wars and Clash of the Titans.
Oh, wow.
So I saw both of these films back-to-back together, and so that's my first memory of seeing this, is that it was a part of that for me.
And I had not seen it, so my first time seeing this film was yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, this came out in 1981. I didn't see it when it first came out, so it probably was a couple of years later after it came out and seeing it at the drive-in. But, you know, seeing it relatively young, I was maybe 7, 8 when I saw it. You know, you are excited by Pegasus, seeing Pegasus, and, you know...
Yeah, Pegasus does look really good.
And you're excited about... And I liked Bobo. But in seeing it now as an adult, it really is not a very interesting film. And Theseus's head falling off. Actually, that scene, I dug that scene.
Yes.
Still to this day, I dug that scene. But I think it's just not a very interesting film.
No, it's not compelling. There's no character.
Yeah, I'm sure...
If you know a little Greek mythology, you get the plot.
Yeah. And I'm sure... The remake is probably at least flashier and has better effects. But, you know, it was really hard to like Perseus. And also, you know, the reason why... Now, you know, Perseus is the son of God, and his mom was impregnated by Zeus when he, turned into a shower of gold and gold coins upon her. But actually, the reason why Perseus and his mom... were set to the sea, were banished, was because Perseus was supposed to kill his grandfather, and that's why they were banished. And so, like, they even changed that particular story. So there's actually, there could have been that whole thing. I know that's a little bit Oedipal,
that part of it.
But yeah, I mean, they didn't even have that, which would have been maybe an interesting dynamic to add to it. But yeah, they're not interesting characters. They're all very, very flat. I think Maggie Smith does a good job in her role. I do think that Laurence Olivier is at least fun as Zeus. Like, at least he has a sense of humor about playing Zeus and what it means. Burgess Meredith tries his best with the character that he plays, which is just an old actor who Perseus is... just put in his theater by Maggie Smith.
Yeah.
Randomly, he just shows up in his theater. But beyond that, beyond just, you know, he has this little adventure along the way. He doesn't have any godlike powers like Hercules. So there's nothing that is gained. And then also, along the way, he gets like a lot of help from Zeus. And he keeps losing everything that he gets help with, so he's given magical equipment, and he has a sword and a shield and a helmet and Bobo, but he keeps losing all this stuff along the way as well, and even his battle with Medusa, and I think maybe it was partially... No, actually, I think the close-ups of Medusa were kind of good, but, like, even his battle with Medusa, and I think it was probably, like, a technical issue at the time, wasn't even that interesting or that exciting with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to move to the questions?
I guess so. Yeah. I guess so. I mean, this is it, folks. This film is a nothing burger. So, is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie?
Well, I don't know. What are you thinking?
It's... The argument for it being camp is the cheesy effects. Hmm. Because the other thing, too, is this the worst kind of bad film in that it's not even interestingly bad, it's not even unapologetically bad.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not The Room, it's not Birdemic, it's not, you know, we watched the 1941 exploitation film Mad Youth, which was so unapologetically an exploitation film.
Yeah. Which at least had character growth and development.
And had character growth and development in it. And lured thrills. And a puritanical message. That's the idea of it being camp. Is that, you know, are the effects that bad? The acting is, like, just good enough to be bland. Like, It's not, like, local community theater bad. It's not that the actors save the film, save a hopeless plot.
Yeah.
They do what they need to do, and it's over.
Yeah.
So I think it might just be an old movie.
I don't think it's fun enough to be camp, to be honest with you.
You're right. Camp does have a sense of fun.
And I think this film takes itself, like, almost way too seriously.
Yes.
It did well financially, so in a way, I would almost respect them if they were just like, we're doing a cash grab.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it does feel like they were trying to take them... And the only reason why I'm saying they're trying to take themselves a little bit too seriously is in the casting.
Yeah.
And they really tried for the gods and goddesses to kind of get some major talent for that. I just think it's an old, uninteresting film.
With a cute owl in it.
With a cute owl. I mean, it's worth it to see the owl and Pegasus.
Yeah.
I like those two.
Which you pretty much just fast forward to...
To the owl and Pegasus. Or to YouTube.
Go to YouTube. Or if you're watching a Laserdisc, start it on side two. Just start it on... Just flip the movie over already. Start it with side two.
Yeah.
Which, you know, there was somebody... I was at Skullfest last year before the COVID. And somebody... We were talking about records. And he's like, I always start my records on side B. I get a new record, I'll listen to it on side B. Because if it sucks, you flip it over and you got side A. Maybe this is the film... Maybe we should have started on side two, and then seeing how we got here, maybe that would have added a little more suspense. I don't know. Question two. What about the social political distance, Bechdel test, race, how it portrays race, etc.? Here's what I'll say.
Okay.
It doesn't do anything, I think, particularly reactionary. Or it doesn't come off as. Excuse me. However, one of the things that has happened, and especially you get to, like, Jordan Peterson trying to bring archetypes back and other types, is that a lot of ancient studies and medieval studies, actually, a lot of those pre-modern fields, cultural studies fields, have... People have, especially on the far right, have really tried to hijack and tell this very simple story of the foundations of European culture and this sort of essentialized, truest, most bedrock.
Yeah.
And that's one way that watching the film in 2020, you know, because, yeah, it is a very white film.
Yeah.
It is a very archetypal film.
Yeah.
It's a very, you know, set in stone, sort of, except for the whole combining of the mythologies. But it does wear a mask of verisimilitude in some ways. You know, it stays a little too honest, the source material. And so my friends who do medieval, my friends who do classics in academia, there is this fine line they have to tread now where it's like, no, this portrayal of ancient, especially European history, is way more simple than the truth.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, if you're plugged into that conversation, mm-hmm. yeah, Clash of the Titans, you know, there is some distance there. Or at least it's guilty of doing what pretty much everybody in every classics department has done into the 1990s.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, you know, I want to say that Joppa, which is where the majority of the film takes place, is in Israel. And then also, you know, Harry Hamlin is very, very tan. But, you know, he's very, very tan. And then, of course, the gods and goddesses are all British with British accents. And they're very, very white. But, you know, you think about it, too, like, so Joppa is in Israel, and then there's partial potential connection that Perseus actually comes from Persia, that he would have been the founding of the Persian Empire. And then, like, Xerxes was making that connection of being a son of a god with it. But Persia would have been Middle East and Turkey, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I think that's also the other thing, is that that's lost.
Yeah.
Because it is, we have these British actors, you have an American actor who's just very, very tan. But the reality of the situation is every character in that film should have had olive skin, right? They should have been a different color. They should have been a different race. And that's lost. And I think, so for me, as to what you're saying, is this kind of like bedrock of history is actually based on people of color.
Yeah.
And that's often ignored, right? And so when we look at Greek mythology and we're thinking about, like, say, Aristotle, which... I know you have a person in your life who's very much a big fan of Aristotle and the truth that is with Aristotle. But the reality of the situation is Aristotle is not European, right? And so that is always really fascinating to me when people look at Greek mythology as, like, this is where, like, heroes come from, and this is, you know, whiteness is based on this, and it's just so not true. And so, I mean, I think there's that's problematic. That's always mm-hmm. problematic. When Greek, you know, we have to just acknowledge Greek mythology, it's huge, right? I mean, the Greek Empire spans multiple countries. It's massive at one point in time. And so that's multiple countries. And that, you know, like, when Europeans did embrace Greek philosophy and Greek mythology, they made it their own and made it white, right? And they took away some of that. You know, the goddesses, like, well, you know, Maggie Smith, Thetis, is interesting. She's kind of fun. But, like, Andromeda is very boring. I wanted to laugh at the one scene where Perseus is going to go to the witches to, you know, find out how to defeat the Kraken. And she's like, I'm going with you. And it's just like this random, it's almost like randomly they're like, oh, we'll show that she's interesting. And it's just this, you know, really badly acted scene where she's like, I'm going too. The women are just not very interesting. I mean, but the men aren't interesting either. So I don't think it's a sexist situation. I just think it's just bad writing.
Well,
and bad acting.
But, you know, but the women, I think, are definitely more passive.
Yeah, that's true.
And the male characters are just the dynamic, the doers, the beers, the... Yeah.
Yeah.
Question four is sort of the room test.
I mean, that's... Yes. I noticed lots of things around it. So, for me...
It is slow enough and uncompelling enough that you remember when Perseus forgets his sword. His magic shield.
Yes.
It's like, here's a magic shield. Great. And then in the next scene, he's walking somewhere and he doesn't have it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no! Continuity error!
Well, even, you know, they use a lot of painted backgrounds, and you really notice that, and that's not done well. And the claymation is not done well. I think with having Calibus, I think Calibus would have been just better of having an actor in full makeup.
Yeah.
And so those fight scenes were not very believable because you're switching between a close-up of the actor and then far away of the claymation dude fighting Harry Hamlin. And those things are bad. Like, that's really noticeable. For me, actually, the one that actually was good was the giant buzzard. Like, I think I was cool with the giant buzzard. He was
giant buzzard looked good. Which I guess is, too, for you know... It's like, maybe this is one, if you watch it, is maybe to watch on a really beat-up VHS copy.
I was actually thinking...
Because it would just get lost in that. I mean...
I was thinking that the exact same thing, because with the Laserdiscs, actually, for the most part, it was pretty good. Like, the quality of the film.
Quality of the film.
There was a
good.
Couple times where lines popped up, but overall, the quality was pretty good. So you did notice those things really well.
And I will say, the other thing is, it was a reminder of, I don't remember the last time I saw a film at home that had cigarette burns in it.
Oh, yeah, that's true. You're absolutely
which they,
right.
They kept those on the Laserdisc.
You're
and the
right.
thing that there was a time, you know, we live in this 2020, it's 4K, you know, it's like so realistic. You could see the veins, you know, kind of thing. But actually, yeah, in the transfer to Laserdisc, they kept the cigarette burns.
They did. But I think, and also, like, if you
and there
know,
were a lot of reels on this film.
There was. And I also, if you know Perseus's tale at all, you're going to get, you're going to be like, what? Like, so you're going to also have these moments of like, but that's not what happened. But that's not, you know. So I think that
and again,
also,
I think the movie moves so slowly. This is an hour and 19 minutes, which also on Laserdisc, you know, 60 minutes aside. So the flip moment is in the middle of a scene.
Yeah.
There's like a line of dialogue and the screen goes black and then it's, you know, turn movie over on your TV. So you gotta like, and then it picks that scene up again.
Well, you know, yes, absolutely. And I think actually for me, thinking about like Calibus, and Calibus is the villain, he is cursed by Zeus because he killed all the other Pegasus, the flying horses, and I guess his cruelty, and so he was deformed and turned into a monster. He actually, like, a couple of his scenes were actually really good. Like, you could actually tell that he was feeling tormented and things like that. So it was like the one character who was kind of interesting is in very brief, and then kind of just shows up to mess up things along the way. But that scene between him and Andromeda was actually kind of heartbreaking. And so it's like, but for the rest of the time, they're like, he's going to be a claymation dude. Let's just have him be claymation. So I think that for me is, it was very noticeable how bad the effects were. Very, very noticeable.
Indeed. So is it a keeper?
No, not for me. How about for you?
Even though you said this is the movie why you love owls.
Oh, that's true. I mean, I love Bobo. I really love Bobo.
Can you throw Bobo away?
No, I guess I can't throw Bobo away. Is it probably going to be another 15 years before I watch this film again? Probably.
I'd say a good 20, 25. I think we'll forget and you'll be nostalgic for the early 80s.
And I'll be nostalgic for Bobo.
And hopefully this giant, you know, Laserdisc, which we will, as it says on the page, when not in use, place video disc in jacket and store in a cool, dry place. It is in a cool, dry place. So hopefully, you know, our plastic crap that we manufacture is forever.
Yeah.
So maybe 20 years from now, maybe we'll revisit.
But I think if you want to check it out, get a bad VHS tape and watch it on a really old TV, like a Radiation King type of TV. and I think you'll enjoy it in that way.
It'll just all blend. The fuzziness and the bad effects will just all come together.
Especially in this day and age, I think we're all so used to really good special effects.
And for a film that was trying to be a spectacle.
Yes. Absolutely.
Doesn't work. Because it doesn't have plot. But, well, it doesn't have character.
Doesn't
have a lot of action.
No.
Whatever.
Yeah.
On that note, I guess that sad note, see you next time.
All right. Bye.